you're listening to The Current. The numbers are hard to wrap your head around. 2,511 people in British Columbia died from unregulated drugs last year. That is an average of 7 people every single day. It was the worst year on record. And that issue of unregulated drugs remains the leading cause of death in people between the ages of 10 and 59 in that province. Lisa Lapointe is BC's chief coroner. Her latest report revealed the numbers yesterday. It's also her last report. She is leaving the job next month. She's in Victoria. Lisa Lapointe, good morning.
Good morning, Matt. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. What do you think about when you release numbers like that, record high death rates from toxic drugs?
Oh, I think about the people. I think about the families in particular. I don't have the opportunity to know the people who died, of course, but I hear from their families and I see the grief and I see the loss. I hear about the people who died and how much they're missed and how much they're loved. And these reverberations that happen across our communities every time somebody dies. And, you know, as you said, 2,511 people, that's 2,511 families times, you know, how many family members, how many friends, how many colleagues. And, you know, there's likely not a family in this province that hasn't been impacted or knows somebody who's died as a result of toxic drugs.
Let's talk about some of the specifics. What is the report? And I've read through it, but from your perspective, what does the report show in terms of what drugs are killing people right now?
Oh, this is a fentanyl crisis. This has been a fentanyl crisis in our province since 2012. In fact, it wasn't a crisis in 2012, but 2012 was when we first saw illicit fentanyl in postmortem toxicology results. And since that time, the exponential growth of fentanyl in the drug stream, in the illicit drug market, from 2016 till now, 2016 was when this public health emergency was declared in BC, fentanyl's been involved in 86% of the deaths. And it's an opioid, highly unpredictable, very not difficult to regulate if you're in a proper lab with very measured controlled environment, but the way that illicit drugs are created, the regulation is very inexact, and that is causing people to die.
What else have you learned about trends in drug use in your province?
So we have seen heroin basically disappear. Heroin was the opioid of choice for those who used opioids for many years. There's virtually no heroin in BC anymore. Fentanyl has taken that over. Fentanyl, as you know, Matt, because I've talked to you about this before, can be created in a home lab with precursors bought off the internet. So it is not a really difficult thing, sadly, to create. But we've also continued to see cocaine and significant amounts, about 40% of the deaths involve cocaine. We see methamphetamine, amphetamines in the 40% range as well, across the board. And then we've seen things like benzodiazepines showing up more often. Benzodiazepines are also sedatives. So when taken with fentanyl, you've got the synergistic effect, and really hard to reverse an opioid overdose when somebody is also taking benzodiazepines. So it's a mess. It's an illicit market. It's not controlled. It's not regulated. It's profit driven. And frankly, the people in our province are at huge risk when they access that market.
The numbers are a bit lower in this latest report, but your office has said unregulated drugs were the leading cause of death among youth in British Columbia from 2017 through 2022. How do you wrap your head around that?
Well, you know, what we've seen is the percentage of youth dying in this crisis has remained, fortunately, fairly low comparatively. So 1 to 1.5% of the deaths each year are youth under 19. But the fact that youth are dying, that this is one of the leading causes of death for youth in our province, it's terrifying. As parents and grandparents, what we faced as young people potentially experimenting, as young people do, we didn't risk losing our lives. And that's
the reality now. And as you see it, as if young people are experimenting, and to your point, that's what young people do. They learn what the limits are. They try things, that they are at risk of losing their lives in that experimentation.
Yes, absolutely. The illicit market is toxic and it's unpredictable. It's frightening. You know, my kids are grown up. I have small grandchildren, and it's terrifying to think that that this potentially is out there for our children.
I want to have you listen to Greg Sword. His 14-year-old daughter Camilla died from an overdose in 2022.
The only hope I get in Brightness is that my daughter didn't die in vain. That something actually comes out of this. I don't want to think that my daughter just was a number and died for no reason and no purpose, and that she didn't matter because she was from just a working class family. But it's hard. Every day is a challenge.
When we spoke with Greg a few months ago, he had yet to receive the coroner's report, but he'd been told that cocaine, MDMA, and hydromorphone were found in his daughter's system. What do you say? And this is just kind of going back to what you were just talking about, how parents are terrified about this. What do you say to someone like Greg, who is seeing this crisis and the real toll of the crisis up close?
Well, my heart goes out to Mr. Sword. My sincere sympathy to him, and the pain that I hear in his voice is pain that I hear in the voices of parents across the province. Whether their child is 14 or 15 or 19 or 30 or 40 or 50 for that matter, the pain is intense. And I've had people say to me, I'm in the middle of a nightmare and I don't know where to go. And we do hear more and more from parents, it's too late for my child, or if it's a sibling or another relative, it's too late for them. But what can we do for other people at risk? And there's this real altruistic sense out there, and I hear from people every day, we need to prevent these deaths. They don't want what happened to their family to happen to another family. This public health emergency in British Columbia has been in place since 2016. We've lost almost 14,000 people. Drug toxicity is the leading cause of death for those aged 10 to 59. We have not seen a response commensurate with the scale of this crisis.
Tell me more about that. You've been the chief coroner in British Columbia through the worst years of that crisis. How would you describe the response by governments to this?
I want to be careful what I say, because I don't want to be discouraging. And there are many, many people working very, very hard every day to try to make a difference. But overall, I would say the response has been very disappointing. What we have not seen is a plan. What is the plan? And many of us have been asking for this for the last 7 years. What are we trying to achieve? And what are the steps that we need to take to get there? So what we've seen are announcements here and announcements there. No evaluation. So we have no follow-up to see if we announced 20 beds, what were the results of those 20 beds? What did we find a year later, or 2 years later, or 3 years later? So that real lack of evaluation, lack of systemic plan for what we're trying to achieve, and then a bit of a lack or an inability potentially to communicate well to the general public what is happening in British Columbia. What are the problems? What are some of the realistic solutions? And let's think rationally about evidence-based measures that will actually make a difference.
You paused before you answered the question and checked yourself in terms of what you wanted to say. What were you trying not to say in terms of that response? You're on your way out now, retiring. What is your honest assessment of how governments have handled this?
I'm not generally a negative person, and I don't want to be negative, but I have found myself becoming more angry over time and more critical over time.
What are you angry about?
I'm angry that almost 14,000 people have died, and that the response from our government has been very I guess I would describe it as lackadaisical. We don't have, when COVID hit our province, for example, in our country, there were plans. We knew that a certain number of people, we either needed to be quarantined for safety, and measures were taken to do that. And then when there were vaccines available, a very methodical plan. How are we going to vaccinate all these people all across the province by age groups, et cetera, et cetera. We haven't seen anything like that with this crisis. So we haven't seen any particular plan. We keep hearing that treatment and recovery are important, and certainly the panels that we've brought together acknowledge absolutely treatment and recovery are critical. But what we still don't have in this province are any reporting requirements, despite the fact that we recommended that back in 2018. So there are services across the province purporting to provide treatment and recovery efforts for people's loved ones. Many of them are private, many of them are for profit. Families are mortgaging their homes to pay for their loved ones to go to treatment. And sometimes the treatment is successful, sometimes it takes 3, 4, 5 times, and sometimes people die. And that's not an uncommon story for us to hear, that somebody has been in a period of abstinence following treatment or recovery. And of course, then they use, their tolerance is so reduced, and they die. And we don't have any rules around reporting. So we actually don't know what are the outcomes. And I mentioned beds. We hear about beds, and the announcement seems to be, okay, we made the announcements for beds, problem solved. But what did those beds do? We have no idea. And certainly what we've seen is that the deaths are mounting and the risk is continuing. And if you talk to people on the front line, what they will tell you is that nothing has changed. They have not seen anything change.
What's at the root of that? Just the last point on this. What do you think is at the root of that? Of what did you call it? A lackadaisical approach?
Oh, I think there are a couple of things. I think one, this is a complex issue, and I don't want to oversimplify. You know, our healthcare across the country is very, very challenging right now. There are not enough clinicians, there are not enough physicians, long waiting lists, people don't have family doctors. This is a healthcare issue. And so, like every other healthcare issue, there's a real dearth of services available. But more than that, I think we're in a transition. So for decades, people who use drugs were treated as criminals. And the force of the law in terms of policing, courts, probation officers, penitentiaries, correctional centers, were used to address the drug use. There is absolute clarity now amongst all levels and types of government and agencies, Canadian chiefs of police, federal crown, federal government, provincial government. This is a health issue. So drug use is a health issue. Using that law enforcement punitive tool has been incredibly damaging and not helpful. So we're in a transition where we're recognizing this is a health issue, but we haven't created any of the infrastructure to respond in a meaningful way to this health issue. And we need to get on that, because across the country, 40,000 people have died as a result of drug toxicity, and more will die. We can't stand and watch these people, our community members, die. And like Mr. Sword said, we need to do something. We need to learn from what's happened and move forward and prevent some of the future deaths.
Let me ask you about one of the interventions, and that is what's known as Safe Supply. Hydromorphone is part of the Safe Supply program. There are doctors who have gone on the record raising the alarm about these sorts of drugs ending up in the hands of young people at parties and beyond because of a lack of oversight. You said that is an urban myth. Are those doctors wrong?
So we haven't seen diagnoses of opioid use disorder in youth increase, and Dr. Henry keeps an eye on that. We certainly haven't seen any increase in deaths amongst youth related to hydromorphone. We see very little hydromorphone in postmortem toxicology testing province-wide, about 3% of tests we've seen hydromorphone. So we don't have any empirical evidence that a hydromorphone is making a difference, but we certainly hear those concerns. I guess for me, it comes down to this. If a child is going to be offered or is seeking substances I would far rather that they access a prescribed, regulated hydromorphone pill than some concoction that may be toxic from the illicit market. Now, that doesn't mean we want our youth using drugs, and I think we need to be clear about that. Safer Supply is not encouraging people to use drugs. Safer Supply recognizes that the people who are using drugs are at serious risk of harm and death. And this is an opportunity to say, okay, we're going to provide you Safer Supply, and then let's talk about some of the other issues that lead to your substance use and where we can help people. Because frankly, and this is, you know, it's blunt, but if you're dead, you don't have any opportunity to access treatment. You don't have any opportunity for recovery. So, you know, I hear these doctors and completely understand their concerns.
But you also call them an urban myth.
Well, the urban myth that that every child out there who's accessing drugs is accessing hydromorphone, and that if it weren't for hydromorphone, they wouldn't be using drugs. That to me is the myth, that somehow diverted hydromorphone is luring children into drug use. We don't have any data that supports that. We don't have any statistics that support that. I completely believe that some child's been offered that, somebody's children have been offered that as a party. I heard a doctor say that. Don't doubt that, but is that having the sort of the critical negative effects that those doctors are espousing? We haven't seen that anywhere.
Pierre Poilievre, the leader of the Conservative Party, who, if you believe the polls, could well be the next Prime Minister of Canada, said this. These are his words: "The theory of Safe Supply is destroying lives. Stop taxpayer-funded hard drugs. Fund treatment and recovery." What would you say, if you were able to talk to Pierre Poilievre, what would you say to him?
I would say to Mr. Poilievre, the discussion is not about Safer Supply versus treatment and recovery. The discussion is about how do we keep people alive? How do we support people to wellness? So treatment and recovery is critical. Treatment and recovery across our country is, I was gonna say sadly lagging, critically lagging. There are no standards right now for treatment and recovery. There's a thousands of different, you know, approaches, these sort of ad hoc approaches, that not-for-profit, for-profit, community-funded services take. Most of them, I'm going to say, are extremely well-intentioned, but we have no data. We don't know what works. We don't know what's effective. We don't know if something's more effective than others. So I would say, yes, we need treatment and recovery, but more than that, we need to look at what do we mean by treatment and recovery. We need to have some regulations for all of these services to be reporting. We need to start evaluating. So yes, but we also need harm reduction measures.
He says that the BC and the federal government's approach to the overdose crisis, in his words, is an abject failure. I mean, we've seen deaths at the highest they've ever been. And I just wonder, is he wrong in saying that the approach thus far has been a failure?
No. So if you look at, for example, British Columbia and Alberta, we both have significant challenges with opioid toxicity in our provinces. Different approaches. British Columbia has taken a more focused harm reduction approach. A Safer Supply, in principle, is available. In actuality, only about 5,000 people in our province out of a possible 225,000 people using drugs have access to Safer Supply. So it's very, very limited. It certainly isn't driving this crisis. Fentanyl is driving this crisis. We know that without a doubt. Alberta is the same. Fentanyl is driving Alberta's crisis. And when we look at their data, they have taken a much more treatment and recovery focused approach, less focused on harm reduction, no Safer Supply. Their deaths are rising. The rate of death in their province more than doubled what our rate of death increased by last year. So the data comes out from the federal government twice a year. You have to almost be in the middle of this crisis to understand all of the data. But if you look at it, Alberta's approach is not working any better than British Columbia's approach. And I think that is a really good argument for a national approach that brings together subject matter experts, that looks at this rationally, thoughtfully. Let's leave the ideology aside, look at the evidence and say, what will actually make a difference? What will save lives? You know, I heard Mr. Polyev in the House of Commons, and I was very saddened to hear the hatred in his voice when he talked about addicts, giving free drugs to addicts. That is dehumanizing. That is polarizing language. That is trying to vilify a group of people as if they don't matter, as if they are criminals, as if they are not worth our time. And I can tell you, like Mr. Sword and the thousands of other families that I speak to, have spoken to over the last 10 years or the 13 years that I've been in this role, any loss of life is heartbreaking, and we are losing valuable members of our community. These people matter. So if Safer Supply will keep people alive, then families would like their loved ones to be able to access Safer Supply and ground them and get them to a place where they are now ready and able to access treatment and recovery services with success.
Let me just ask you, we're out of time, but let me ask you two final very quick questions. One is, do you see hope for the crisis to be turned around?
I see so many people in communities working so hard to turn this around at a grassroots level, social services, community groups, who recognize that the people who are using drugs are people, they are their loved ones, they are their friends, and trying to bring a human perspective to this. We're talking about, if we talk about a patient-focused service, a human-focused response. What do people need? Let's ask people who are using drugs, what would help you? And so I do think there's hope. We certainly know across the board, including from law enforcement, this is a health issue. So that's a huge shift. It shifted from a crime issue to a health issue. But the all of the infrastructure for that needs to be built. It isn't ready, and so that's where we need to go. And I do see hope, but it's going to take time.
And just finally, thousands of those people have died during your tenure as chief coroner. We talk a lot about the moral injury of some of this work. How are you holding up through this?
Oh, it's been hard. It's been hard. The longer this goes on, and the more families I hear from, and the more despair and grief, you wear it. I wear it. I'll be at home and I'll be staring into the distance. My husband will say, "What are you thinking about?" And I'll say, "The toxic drug crisis." I think about this 24/7. And I feel badly that I'm leaving now when there is so much to be done. But honestly, Matt, I'm tired. I'm not sure I have it in me to continue to do this work at this pace. And there will be people who will come in and take up this this role and this work, and I will be there behind them. I don't intend to walk away from this issue. It's too important. But I think there will be other people who will take the reins and continue to lead in a really positive way.
I'm glad to talk to you again, Lisa Lapointe. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Matt. Take care.
Lisa Lapointe is British Columbia's chief coroner. She is leaving that post in February. Well, coming up after your reading.